Much indeed, Pastor Golf, for your very kind invitation and your introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here. At the very outset of this talk, I want to thank the Historical Committee for giving us the splendid opportunity to speak about the history of Grange Baptist Church. And I want also to put on record my appreciation of men such as the late Dr. Joshua Thompson, Dr. Harry Gribben, David P. Keenan, R.A. Poggs and Dan Skilling, and others who did sterling work in the 1960s and since to really make Baptists in Ireland aware of their historic roots. Now, it would be impossible for me to cover 200 years of history inside the campus of 7:30 or before. So, I'm afraid I have to just offer what I would consider to be reflections on Grange Baptist Church, and I have many of them. In case you're unaware of where Grange Baptist Church is, think of Portland Owen and Ronaldstown. Well, all the way around, if you wish. Ronaldstown's here, and you go to Portland Owen, which is a fairly straight road. 5 miles up, you'll see a crossroads. To the right, you'll see a Hockle. To the left, Tim Bridge, you'll see a signpost for Grange Baptist Church, and you'll see a pub as well. So if you want to wet your whistle before you come, go ahead, half a mile or thereabouts, you come into a hill, you'll see the lovely Loch Ney on the left, slightly the edge of it, Loch Beg here, and the Spurns, and on a nice day you'll see the Spurns there too, and Grange is just right down there on the right-hand side, and it's been there as a building, 1837. And that is very old for a Baptist church. Of course, the building now has been added to and so on, but still, it goes back to that spot, although the church was in fact formed in 1811. I need to explain two things first, I think, in order to put this into context. The Baptist Irish Society was founded in April 1814. Now, it's not founded in Ireland, it's founded in England, by English Baptists, Calvinistic Baptists, at that time. It was brought into existence specifically to propagate the gospel in Ireland by English Calvinistic Baptists headquartered in London. A corresponding committee was set up in Dublin, and several brethren in Ireland were appointed. The society was concerned with tract distribution, the setting up of schools in which the Irish language would be exclusively taught and used. The Irish Testament was read by readers, and that was a most effective instrument of evangelism. It was agreed that Irish men of the right stamp would be better itinerants than English men. I would say a very wise stratagem. Understandably, the main focus of BIS activity was the south and west of Ireland. But from about the mid-19th century, there's a shift of activity to the north. The BIS committee appointed agents, a bit like a spy film, agents they were called, but they're really evangelists, missionaries, mostly Irish men, but also men from Great Britain. They took charge of a station, that's equal to church, and they also had responsibilities for nearby outstations, that equals cottage meetings. The BIS took the major decisions regarding the appointment of personnel, the agent's remuneration, and where each agent was to settle. Now, the Baptist magazine is the next thing to consider briefly. The Baptist magazine is not the Irish Baptist magazine I'm referring to. That's the magazine that was established in 1809 by the same Baptist, generally Calvinistic persuasion. And in 1814, it came to carry a supplement entitled The Irish Chronicle. It was in this section that the reports were published, which were sent in by the various agents in Ireland, bearing in mind that the BIS organised itinerant evangelism, schools, tract distribution and relief work, especially during the famine. It was the purpose of these men was to monitor from time to time and report progress of the Irish mission. It is from this magazine that we get a great deal of crucial information which is pertinent to the witness of the Baptist tradition in Ireland and how that tradition developed over time. It's a very exciting story. When I was asked to write the history of Grange Baptist Church in 2009, I made sure I consulted other church histories to see how they were done and how they were researched and how they read. Very important, the reading, I think, of a church history. I learned much from that exercise. I came to the conclusion that I had a great opportunity to write a church history with a difference. My wife was my best critic. I asked her to read the church histories as well, see what she thought. So I learned from that as well. So first, the story of the church had to be told. That was the first thing, that's top priority. But I tried to avoid tedious matters such as finance, etc., except where that's really necessary. Secondly, I concentrated on people who lived at Grange at Ballyscullion. What kind of people did they live there? What kind of people were they? Who owned the land? How did the people make ends meet? In other words, how were they employed on the land? And what was the religious geography of the district? That was vital. And of course, we had wonderful information in the Ordnance Survey memoirs, which are heavily used in the book at the early stages. So my aspiration in writing the history, this history of a body of religious, or about a body of religious dissenters in County Antrim, was to make a modest contribution to local historical study. Third, I thought it necessary to indicate who Baptists were, what was their origin and development in Ireland. This can be found in the first chapter. Also important in this regard, I felt it necessary to give some indication as to the beliefs and practices of Baptists, and this can be gathered at various points in the narrative. Finally, I was minded to ensure that if anyone read this book on my right, they would be left in no doubt as to what the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ was and how it changed and does change human lives. This was not superimposed on the church narrative as such. It was indeed an essential part of the story of the Grange Church. And so this too is brought out at various points in the Grange story. Now, it's an amazing thing what happens nowadays in research. But that little thing that I have in my hand contains 63 volumes of Baptist magazines, each about 750 pages long, all of which is trawled through page by page for information. It also contains this book, plus 1901-1911 census details of the area. There's 146,000 words in the book. So it's amazing how things have changed in collecting information. And I got all of that on the internet downloaded, because it's free of copyright. But there were certain ones we didn't get, unfortunately. 1864 Baptist magazine does not occur, not found in the Baptist library, and right after 1870 and thereafter, there's none there. So I knew there was crucial information we were going to miss if we didn't research it properly. So William Bailey, church treasurer, and myself went to Oxford for about a week in September 2010, I think it was. Yes, and we uncovered amazing information in the Regent's Park College in the Angus Library. We were there at every possible moment. You can be sure. The source coming at half an hour before the time. So it was really a great experience to do that, and we found a remarkable amount of information which is for the first time in this book. Now, we'll move on then to the origins of the Grange Church. And to say the least, it had very peculiar beginnings. A very important point to state at this stage is that the BIS were not involved in the establishment of Grange, nor did they aid the Grange for a very considerable period. In fact, the first time that they aided the church was 1863. The first reference to Grange Baptist Church that I could find is in the Baptist magazine 1836, page 548, which gives a list of 32 Baptist churches in Ireland. No foundation date, membership numbers, or minister is given for Grange Church. Reason being that they didn't really know. And the man that filled in the form, I think, was the Reverend Allen, who was in Ballina, which is in the west of Ireland, of course. But it's interesting just to see that they were mentioned at that point. But they had no minister up until the 1850s, I would say. Providentially, however, we have a priceless document in the form of the first known history of the Grange Church, entitled A Brief History of the Baptist Church at Grange, County Antrim. This was first published in 1853, and thankfully the Bailey family had a copy of this, and lo and behold, we found the same copy in Oxford University and Regent's Park College. They couldn't believe, William who had the copy, couldn't believe his eyes, nor could I. So they have a copy of it there, going back to that time. The author was the Reverend Robert McMaster, who describes himself as a junior pastor in the church at that time. So this man was very gifted, undoubtedly. McMaster was a gifted man, and his life is full of great interest. A remarkable person. But before I say something about him, let me examine briefly the origins of the Grange Church. The three poles. Number one, the Grange Presbyterian Church and the prevailing situation around it. The Scottish connection in the form of the Haldane brothers, Robert and James. They were crucial in their evangelism in Ireland at the time. And thirdly, we have the Tullamore Presbyterian Church, and in the form of, you only can think of one man when you think of Tullamore, Alexander Carson. He had a crucial bearing in the history of Grange. I don't think he ever spoke in Grange. I could never find any evidence that he did. But he certainly had influence, and he was a remarkable man altogether. Now, I'm quoting here and referring to some of these facts here from McMaster's book. And he was a very beautiful writer, really classically trained, and you can see that in the way he constructs his sentences. The background to this, of course, starts off with the General Synod of Ulster meeting at 1820 in Cookstown. In early times, the Presbyterians of Grange constituted a distinct congregation under the care of the Synod, but they were afterwards united with the congregation of Dunedin under the ministry of the late Mr. Scott, and enjoyed the half of that gentleman's official services. That in the decline of his life, their congregation gradually fell away, and shortly after his demission, was literally dissolved as a Presbyterian body. Memorialists accounted for this dissolution by stating that many of their members had been led astray by itinerant and self-constituted preachers. That's a bad reference, isn't it? That these members were now convinced of their error, that their whole body were anxiously desirous of being taken again under the care of the Synod and prayed to be recognised as a separate congregation. Now, McMaster was living in 53 or possibly before that, so he would have known people in the church who were alive when he was around to get the information. And that information cooperates with the Ordnance Survey memoirs. Largely speaking, it does. So he's a reliable source. According to McMaster, this man, Scott, though not an avowed Arian, he said, first of all, he had a very long and exciting ministry, being accused of high treason and being acquitted in 1798. He certainly was. He clearly was involved in the United Irishmen Rebellion, and as many Presbyterians were, and of course he got off by the skin of his teeth, I think. According to McMaster, he came to the end of his ministry at 1804, roughly. But he often said, though not an avowed Arian, Mr. Scott, like many of his brethren in the Synod at that time, was sadly defective in exhibiting the character of Christ. Of his sermons, there is no distinct recollection, except that they were few in number, and consequently, frequently repeated. Is that ring a bell? And that the glorious gospel, the good news of God's way of saving the gone godly, were not in them. Ah, it's a real gem. McMaster's a gem to read. So, for all intents and purposes, McMaster viewed the church as having been abandoned by the Presbyterian authorities. It therefore appears from about 1805 to the early 1814, the local Palomina Presbytery left the worshippers at the Grange Church to their own devices. Now, you know and I know from experience when there's a gap or vacuum, something has to fill the vacuum. and come the Hallnail brothers. Not personally. Robert and James Hallnail were distinguished men of learning and also of material fortune. They were in the Navy and then they decommissioned and they came into more or less to evangelism and spreading the gospel. 1798, Robert, with all of friends, established this, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel at Home, which was for Scotland, Ireland, and England. And he financed the whole thing. He sold his large estate, which is now the home of Stirling University. So he financed all that, and he set up a seminary in 1799 to train men for 2 years and send them out to preach the gospel. And one of those men was a Mr. Douglas. And he, what a character, as you'll discover in the book. I'm going to just touch on some of those things, but he's an interesting man. Now, the background to this, of course, is very interesting here too, because it involves Ballycraig, a Congregationalist church. And there's a man who was a minister in the 1950s, Dr. Alan Cairns. He was Donegal Street Congregationalist Church. He wrote a private thesis one time, which I finally got hold of. And he writes, from an appendix in the Irish Evangelical Society's report for 1853, the Irish Evangelical Society was founded around the same time as 1814, or the same as BIS, but they were mainly a Congregationalist body. It is learned that the district of Ballycraig was first occupied and a chapel built through the efforts of the brothers Haldane of Scotland. It was probably under their direction and by their support that a Mr. Douglas, a Scot, preached principally in the open air during the year 1804-05. Now, this man, Douglas, was undoubtedly a very effective communicator. Suave, well-dressed, looked the part, had that charisma, which is hard to explain, really. His popularity, he were told, with the Presbyterian peasantry was really astonishing. So, Mr. Douglas was quite a character. He was effective as a gospel communicator, but he didn't have too much interest in protocol and setting up a church. He appointed the elders himself, and they set up a church, as it were, in the Lord's table, and he was the official person doing it, was heading over it. That didn't please McMaster, I'm afraid. McMaster says, "You're to administer the ordinance, therefore, to any assembly, however constituted, from the apart from the Church of Christ, is an act against which we feel called on to record our humble testimony with all possible earnestness." Look at how he puts that. He doesn't make a big claim, but he says we're earnest about this. This man's a fraud. He's unconstitutional. He isn't doing this properly. But there was two other areas where he didn't feel he was up to scratch. He was morally defective, in other words. After searching, a search and investigation, that is to say, after Douglas applied to be a member of the Masonic fraternity, it was proved that he was not a Freemason at all, but a clever imposter. And then the next thing that happened to him, of course, he was a ladies' man, no doubt. He was suave, looked quite young for his age. He was middle-aged. Though approaching the middle age, McMaster says, he retained a remarkable fresh and youthful appearance. And to a handsome person, he added the additional attractions of graceful manners and fascinating conversation in society. So he was quite a handful, this man. He took up with a lady, a local lady, we don't know who her name was, thank goodness, and that was okay. He planned marriage, but the parents and friends thought there was something a bit fishy about the whole thing, and they inquired and discovered he was married with children in Scotland. And I like the way McMaster puts this. We need hardly add, his immediate expulsion from the neighbourhood followed as a matter of course. You can fit that for sure. His departure took place in 1808, and of his subsequent history, nothing authentic is known in this country. And so ended the career of Mr. Douglas. The second factor here is the Scottish connection with this man, these Haldane brothers, and with these this man Douglas. But there were other people who were sent to preach as well. We don't know their name, but there were quite a number who came from Scotland to preach at that time. Now, the third factor is, of course, Tobermore Presbyterian Church. and Alexander Carson's a key figure here. Now, the Presbyterian Church at the time was in bad fettle as regards spirituality and the way people behaved. The 18th century is the age of enlightenment, the age of new ideas coming in from Europe and from France and into the universities. People went over to Glasgow to be trained for the Presbyterian ministry. They caught these ideas, you see. Arianism crept in, that's the denial of Jesus' divinity. That meant a slackening of discipline in the churches. The Presbytery of Antrim was wholly Arian in their sentiments at this time. It took a man like Henry Cook to pull them back to orthodoxy again. That's his significance in the 19th century. But he wasn't at this time very, very strong, and he was training at this time. Thomas Wethero was a man who was a junior minister in Markerlaa Presbyterian Church, 1855. He wrote this, and this is how he described the situation. And this explains precisely the background to Carson coming out of the Presbyterian Church. The most trustworthy accounts bear that with the symptoms of spiritual life were then comparatively few and feeble. He's really looking back on things, 1810 or thereabouts. The great enterprises which of late years have engaged so much public attention have not then been entered upon. There were no missions, no Sabbath schools, and evangelistic labours beyond the precincts of the meeting house. They were very rare indeed. The Westminster Confession had fallen into disrepute. There was a falling away of clear moral, spiritual power in the church. A biographical sketch of Mr. Carson by Mr. J. Young is also very interesting. Since the plantation of Ulster in the early 6th, 17th century under James I, it was a practice of the government to pay the Presbyterian ministers, known as the Rigi and Dunham. They were paid from the public purse. Now, that wouldn't, of course, go down well with the Baptists, would it? For obvious reasons. However, that's what happened. And that had a certain consequence, according to Young. The ministers soon ceased to bear testimony against the evils and corruptions of the age. They became worldly-minded and spent their time in cultivating their fine farms. These are ministers. Instead of faithfully preaching the gospel and laboriously tending the vineyard of the Lord, religion was soon allowed to take care of itself. Church discipline fell into neglect. Evangelical truth gave way to moral essays, and often to absolute Socinianism, a deviation from Christian belief, in which the whole scheme of human redemption was neutralized. Regeneration and holiness of heart and life were scouted as unnecessary and fanatical. The church courts became arenas for angry debate between the Orthodox and the Arians. The true courts almost abandoned the land. Tough times. Well, Carson saw the situation. He reported all this indiscipline in the church to the authorities. They wouldn't listen. And in 1804 he left. And he wrote in 1805, Reasons for Separating from the Synod of Ulster in 1805. That's the date. And he goes on here to say, McMaster makes a very important point here, which is crucial for the beginning of Grange. Dr. Carson, having left the Synod, did in the year 1805 publish his reasons for separating from that body in a pamphlet of surpassing interest and importance. This fact has become known at the Grange. The reasons for separating from the Synod of Ulster were procured, read, and highly appreciated by the friends in that locality. Well, I have a copy of it, and this tough going. Must have been pretty sharp people at Grange, and indeed they were, as we'll later see. And it was resolved to apply to Mr. Carson to have, if at all possible, an evangelical preacher to send to Grange. And of course, this is the connection between Carson and Haldane. They knew each other. The brothers knew Carson and vice versa, because Carson was trained in Glasgow University. He was our leading student when he left in classics. He got the top marks. He was an astounding man, Carson. Great admiration for him. For a man to stand or to stay at the bottom of the Spurrins for almost the entire length of his tenure as a minister, it's amazing how humble a man was. And yet he had the power, the intellectual power, to be the professor of any university in the UK. He was asked actually to stay at Glasgow University, but he didn't. He felt the call to ministry. So you have this backdrop then, that they need people at Grange to come after this man had left. For a man was sent, a Mr. Gray. He came in 1807 and was set 1810. He was an independent man. Now, the Haldane brothers at this point were Congregationalists. And after a fashion, so was Tarson. Tarson was not a Baptist all of a sudden. It's a gradual transition to his position as a Baptist. And that's exactly the same thing that happened in Grange and also with Coleraine. So we have here then this Mr. Gray. He was a good man. He wasn't going to accept baptism by immersion for believers, so he went his way in other direction. The Haldane brothers also produced a magazine called The Christian Magazine. It was circulated at Grange, and it gave examples of people sometimes leaving Congregationalist Church on Baptist principal grounds. So that sort of stirred the pot too, you see, for these people. So in 1809, Grange, those people who worshipped in Grange Church meeting house, became an independent church, but not Baptist. So we go on then from there on, and there's a man then after this man Gray comes in. It's a very, very clear line of separation. And this is a time when the two brothers, that's the two Haldane brothers, become Baptists in their sentiments, as does Carson. So the next man they send isn't a Congregationalist, but a Baptist. Makes sense, doesn't it? So the man who came was the Reverend Rogers, and he came in 1811, and that's when the church, you could say, is properly formed. A gentleman by the name of Mr. Samuel Clark, who attended the Grange meeting house, desired to be baptized as a believer. I think upon his conviction, he made his way to Tobermore in the spring of 1811, and there he was baptized by the Reverend Carson, who had by this time adopted Baptist principles. So that's the sort of outline, if you like, of the church in terms of those three sort of very important triangular points, in the sense that these all came together at a certain period of time, maybe 5 to 10 years, and these people then start to come and think about baptism. This man Clark leads the way, and thereafter then they become duly baptized, and they're now then a Baptist church. McMaster makes a very interesting point, which I can't touch on here, but it's in the book, fully discussed. People who were in the church from 1811 to 1849 were a mixed bunch. They were not all baptized believers. So he calls this principle of tacit compromise. And that's exactly the same thing that happened at Tobermore and Coleraine as well. Coleraine were divided early by Congregationalists, and they divided in 1830, I think, into Congregationalists and Baptists. You'll see an article by Mr. Gribben, one of the Gribbens, in 1800, and tells you the background of the history of that church there, and that's exactly the same thing that happened. And there was a very strong connection between Carson and Tobermore and Coleraine, because one of his sons was a minister there at one stage. And then, of course, Grange, we never got a visit from Carson, I don't think, but there was that sort of tie-up. Those three churches were very important in that area, because Ballymena wasn't at that time in thought of. So, looking at those three factors, I think you'll find it very interesting if you read that first or second chapter, because that's where a lot of the research was done to try and pin down exactly who was who. And that's what historical research is about, really. So you have Mr. Douglas from 1805, 1808, Congregationalist, evangelist, disappears without trace. Reverend Gray, 1807, 1810, independent church is formed, but not a Baptist church. Reverend Rogers comes 1811, 1813. He's the first Baptist minister, and from that point, 1811 seems to be the date. And there's not one deviation from that date in all the data throughout the whole 19th century, 20th century that I've ever seen. Not one deviation. So that would be a fairly secure date. Now, regarding the Reverend McMaster, we couldn't let him go without a few words about him. He's a very interesting person, and I've given a lot of information about him here. He's a person that you'd love to have met him, really. He was quite a character. After his death, the Reverend Robert Eccles, he was a son of W.S. Eccles, He was a minister of Grange, and he then had the job of writing his what is it called, in memoriam, his obituary, and he wrote some very wonderful words here. I'm sure there'll be many people that will agree with this first paragraph. For many years before his death, 1879 he died, this servant of Christ was prevented from exercising his public ministry by the painful effects of general rheumatism, and of course in these days of prevalent ingratitude. To cease to be a prominent worker is to be almost forgotten, no matter how great previous services. I'll ring a bell. The pastors? I think it would. Politicians too, when you're in the light for so many years, then you're suddenly gone, forgotten about. How true that is. Nothing has changed there, I'm afraid, I think. He was chosen a pastor, according to this, of the Grange Church, although we in Salt City was a junior pastor. And by his sound teaching, did much to produce in that little community the intelligence for which it used to be noted. Mr. McMaster was fond of helping the young. To a juvenile orator who had one evening felt his wings somewhat clipped or weak, the kind pastor said in private, "Four things, my dear boy. Read much. Think much. Write much. And speak much. And there's no fear of success." Oh, good advice. Especially the writing part. It's unusual to see a man referred to in an obituary having faults. Well, they didn't have any political correctness then. And our friend Robert McMaster, or Robert Eccles, who knew him very well, he said, "Faults he had, of course. The principal were a loftiness of spirit, tending sometimes on pride, and an impetuousness merging sometimes into hastiness. His kindness, pitifulness, and wisdom made him the guide, philosopher, and friend of his neighbourhood. He had a good side too. No sick bed, but he was summoned to. No lawsuit, but he was first consulted. No will was right till it had been revised by him. And thus doctor and lawyer were often deprived of patient and client. As a preacher of the gospel, he was clear, fervent, and useful. As a pastor, he shepherded his flock. As a minister among ministers, he was courteous and helpful. His slight form, lofty forehead, intelligent features, and venerable bearing were conspicuous anywhere. The green turf of the graveyard lies under no gentler Christian bosom or no clearer Christian head than that of Pastor Robert McMaster." Beautifully written. Robert Eccles was taught, no doubt, by his father, who was a classical scholar, and he knew so well to write and how to be precise and balanced. It's beautiful to read that at writing of the 19th century. Well, that's this man McMaster. He was quite an unusual man. He was a pastor of sorts in 1850s. When he came to the church, I cannot find out, but we do know that he was a pastor of a new church in Portland Owen due to the 1859 revival, and he was a pastor there in 1870, and then he had to retire to rheumatism, and he's buried just one mile from roughly about from the old graveyard of Ballyscullion, and there's a very large monument for him, the Reverend Robert McMaster. But his death certificate says he was a grocer. So whenever you go into the depths and research, you can see there's a few puzzles it's hard to explain. I reckon he was part-time pastor, and maybe his wife looked after a wee shop and kept things together. That'd be the sort of way I would reason it out. Anyway, so that's the Reverend McMaster. He was a man that fascinated us greatly in the early stages of our writing. Now, there's a lot more I can say, but I have to go to skip here because time's going to beat us. However, I just refer very briefly before I come to a man called, I could never leave out William Eccles, ever, from the history of any talk about Grange Baptist Church, for he was such an astounding man. But before he came, the first man to come to Baptist Church in Grange was Hugh Henry Bourne. He was the first person to be appointed by the Baptist Irish Society. And was he an unusual man? He certainly fits the bill for that determination, all right. He was in 15 years, he was pastor in 10 churches. You get the feeling he was a bit of a freewheeler. However, he was an outstanding man, and we went to Oxford, we found out a lot about him we didn't know about. We never knew about this mantle about 2010, having ever been existed. And yet he was an outstanding individual. He was a colossal personality, I think. His photograph's in the book. It's the first photograph we have of anybody in the book, chronologically speaking. And he ended up actually in Berkshire in Windsor Baptist Church, and he married a little girl in 1874 who died from diphtheria, and he got the disease the next year. He was paralysed for 25 years in his throat, couldn't speak. But he wrote books of encouragement. I saw six of them in Oxford. And in one of the books, he sent into the Agnes Library and he put his little cameo photograph on the title page. And that's how we got his photograph. He hadn't got to Oxford, we never got it. He was an outstanding individual. He came to Portadown first of all, and he's a sketch writer, and he tells us all about Portadown and all about the background to it. And the same thing that happens in Grange. He sends three or four reports, but they're full of so much information about the area. For example, in one place he says, people wonder how all the people come to these two churches, that's the Presbyterian and the Baptist, when there's only eight or nine houses in the neighbourhood. That's a little bit of information. It's so crucial to build up the kind of people that lived there and how far they had to come to the church. So that's the effect. You're looking for that kind of information all the time, which I found was very fascinating. So we come very briefly to the Reverend William Sloan Eccles. Outstanding man of most people. Most of the people I've read about and researched, I know I'm comparing people here, but I would think he would be the most outstanding man of ability in Grange Baptist history. I would place him as close as possible to Alexander Carson in ability. But because he was an evangelist in his heart, he was a tireless worker. He didn't have time to write too many books, but he did write one when he was in The Nature and Extent of Christ's Suretyship. It's actually an essay on the atonement. It's a refutation of a Wesleyan minister at the time, and he was an outstanding debater, no doubt about that. He was an outstanding man. For a man, for him to come to stay at Grange, it's just amazing. It's the same thing with Carson. And one of his friends actually did actually write this one time. I remember reading this. The Reverend Millard, I think, was the man's name. He was the secretary of the Irish Mission, and he writes, this is what he writes about this man, W.S. Eccles. It seems to me a perfectly monstrous thing to find out our dear brother Eccles, for example, a man of high culture and distinguished gifts, preaching a Grange corner, a road crossing, where perhaps a dozen houses stand together, in a low chapel that will seat no more than 150 folk. The low chapel, you know. I do not doubt that even in that thinly peopled district, that he might have twice or thrice this number if he had but a larger and better chapel. And I was glad to learn that his congregation are proposing to erect one. It never was erected, unfortunately. He says he is a good driver and sometimes keeps and grooms his own horse. He mounted the jumping car as the sun stoops to the horizon and are soon crossing the wide spaces of reclaimed bogland. We meet scores of barefooted but neatly bonneted women returning from field labour and sturdy men carrying the long-handled turf cutting spade. We pass many a roadside cottage with a large population before the doors because of children, and especially of children and poultry. And with many a kindly salutation to the missionary, Mr. Eccles, whose generous and loving toil is well known and highly valued by them, they are all passed and left behind. For now we are climbing steep hills and presently are on lofty moorlands where the air is keen, even in July, and gives us prospects of 5 or perhaps 10 miles on every hand. So he was an unusual man, this man, and there's so much you can say about him, but he was born many more. outside Moneymore. His father was Presbyterian. He was brought up in a very godly home and dedicated to the Lord as a young boy. He then studied at a school at Moneymore, a little school in Moneymore. There's a lovely, lovely scene here I managed to pick up about him. Really, really wonderful the way this is written. I can find it. Yes. When he was a young boy at school. Often when the young youthful learner's head was bent over his Euclid or mensuration, the domine or teacher would steal up and, caressingly patting the boy's abundant curls, would say, "Willie, there are brains beneath those curls, as people will one day know who look to see it." We haven't a picture of him, unfortunately, or a sketch. But John Douglas, who was a Markerfelt man, he was an educated man too, who sat under the ministry of Carson, became a BIS worker in Waterford and also over in Wales. He wrote about him, he knew him very well. He was of a prepossessing appearance, about middle stature. His forehead was round and lofty, indicative of great mental ability. His gestures when preaching were quiet till he warmed with a scene. Then they became hurried, his whole frame quivering with emotion. His enunciation was rapid, exceedingly rapid, resembling the rush of a thundering cataract. He easily acquired the earnest attention of his audience. He went to Belfast Academy, where they trained Presbyterian ministers at that time. He was a great debater, and he was asked one day during the course of his first year to debate proposition that of the scriptural warrant for child baptism. He couldn't do it. He had a crisis of conscience. He left the Presbyterian fold and went back to where he came from. He attended Alexander Carson's church in Tullamore. He encouraged him. Carson was a terrific encourager of people. And he met his wife there. I don't know who she was or her name, but after he met her in Tullamore, and Carson advised him to go to Bristol Baptist College. He was there. I've traced him there at 1836-38. And he went over to Paris to study or to teach English to students. And he acquired further proficiency in English or French, German, Italian. He knew Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and Syriac. So he's a multilingualist. Sounding man. So when he came to Grange in 1866, things weren't so good, but during that period of his ministry, 1872 is a crucial year because there was a revival in 1872 that went beyond the effects of 1859. And that we only discovered that when we did the research because 1872, they didn't have those journals in the Baptist College here in Moira. And that's when we just got all this information out. And it's a remarkable thing to see what happened there at that time. There's some wonderful little cameos there that really very moving. And this man, Eccles, was a great writer. He's always writing reports, and there's so much about what he was doing. He was a fastidious writer, sending in reports time and again. And you get these beautiful pictures painted by him. One man, an old man, was getting baptized. "Gracious Father," he said, he just spoke out and praised the man who had been baptized. "Gracious Father, have compassion on my poor old grey head. Help me to withstand the attack of the scorner. Give me the humility and trustfulness of a little child in following my dear master. May I never be ashamed of Christ, and save me, oh save me, from ever bringing shame upon my holy profession." What a marvellous prayer. And then a little girl, a 7-year-old, she said, "I am not afraid to die." She was ill and he was attending her, because Eccles was a doctor as well. Pastor, doctor, scholar, evangelist, you name it. He was all in. "Sin only can make me afraid, and Christ, the Lamb of God, has taken my sin away. I know indeed I am a sinner, a great sinner, but the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses from all sin. I am trusting to him alone. All things are now ready. God wants nothing more than what our Saviour has done for us. He is well pleased with us for his sake. I should be sorry to leave behind those whom I love, but then, you know, I should be with Jesus." Eccles exclaimed, "Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings I have perfected praise." You'd rarely ever get anybody coming up with that sort of expression in your 7-year-old. So they must have been very well-taught youngsters at that time. So, so there's much more I could say, but I can't because time's gone. And if you want to read about the 72 revival, it's in the book chapter 7. You'd be astounded. You'd need to be a man made of steel or a woman made of steel if you weren't moved by the way those men worked. I mean, Eccles was an outstanding individual of it, the way he worked. He was working very often into the early hours of the morning, 2:30, 3 o'clock, pulling in trap. He services about 12 stations, substations around the church. He travelled. People didn't. He went to them. He was a doctor. He went into all the different houses, Catholic and Protestant. At the end of his life, he died only when he was 62 because he was just worn out. He was in 5 churches, I think. He was in Coleraine, Abbey Street, Academy Street in Belfast before it became Great Vic. He made an impression there. Banbridge, during the revival, his son became a Christian during the revival at Banbridge, Robert. And then he came to Ballymena at a very bad time because Reverend John McVicar had been the pastor there. He took 100 people away from the church to start a Brethren Assembly. So there 11 people left. So that's whenever he came to the church. So then he got moved to Grange, and he was in Grange the longest period of time. He was a BIS agent for 38 years. He was probably the most revered agent that the committee ever had. There were 7.5 pages in the Baptist magazine of an obituary for Robert Eccles. I never saw an obituary so long and right across the whole century. He was an outstanding man, and one that we should be proud of was part of the Irish Baptist fraternity. There's another book on Eccles, easily, but it'll take time to get it done. But he is an outstanding individual, and one that I think you'd be deeply moved by the way that man worked and how he worked with the people and how the people loved him. At the end of his life, he had a funeral which was essentially private, but unfortunately it wasn't private. People just couldn't stay away. Though the funeral was virtually private, it was attended by about 1,000 people. The Roman Catholic priest and a large number of his flock were present. Presbyterians and Episcopalians, ministers were present. 2 neighbouring Presbyterian ministers conducted the funeral service. Catholics and Protestants sought eagerly to carry the coffin. On every side, expressions of the deepest regret were heard. In the sequestered burying ground of Temple Moyle, that's just beside the church in Ballyscullion, in the neighbourhood of the little Episcopal church, that's just over here, graveyards there, awaiting the second coming of which he loves to speak, the earthly remains of an Irish missionary, of whom it may be said, in the words of the secretary of the Irish branch of the Evangelical Alliance, his work was done, and done well. W. S. Eccles. Thank you very much indeed. Yes, okay, sorry. I'll have to wet the whistle. Now, I'm suffering from the cold the last week. Now then, if you have any questions, you can ask them. You can think of them as I do this little blob here. The book here is 352 pages long, beautifully bound. I was very glad whenever I was told by the authorities in the Grange that I wanted a high quality job done. So it's all done on the properly imprinted here. Hardback copy will last a lifetime. Fairly well researched, I would think, from what I could find. There's a man there you could read about. Outstanding man. A man called Thomas Ezekiel McClure. Died only when he was 44 years old. Tragedy to the church. Thomas McClure was the most outstanding man, one of the most outstanding men in the church's history. He was a pastor in all but name. His early tragic death when 44 years old, just died from a heart attack, was a grievous loss to the Green Baptist Church. You'd find a lot of inspiring things in that book, and it's marked 24.85, and it's worth that, but we're only charging £10. It's a giveaway. For a present especially. Last a lifetime, lovely. Dickerson Basler Printers in Belfast, high quality firm. It was expensive to purchase, undoubtedly. We're losing money, but the gospel's in the book. That's the important thing. And it's done hopefully in a nice proper way, balanced way. And also what Baptists are, what they stand for, is also in the book. And it's important to get that message across, and there are politically correct days. But we are a distinctive people. We have a very radical understanding of the church. We have a very good emphasis on how we should become believers, because it's a personal choice between ourselves and God. There's emphasis on human responsibility as there is in God's sovereignty. It's all there in the book, so £10. William's the man you pay. He's the treasurer. William Bailey. So, if you have any questions or anything, I'll be glad to have, if I can, the time remaining. All satisfied.
What was your most startling finding? Of all the stories, all the things, what was the thing that just was the wow factor?
1872 revival. Outstanding. Couldn't believe it. The three men involved. John Taylor, he was, not the John Taylor here now, John Taylor from Tandragee. He was a BIS worker for 35 years. Outstanding evangelist. He was asked to come by Eccles to come and hold meetings in 1872. He did do, place was alive with the gospel, or had meetings at 12 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning. Endlessly. Then a Matthew Simpson, he was the Reverend Mount of the Simpson, he was at clock for a while, and also with Mullah Carr. He was a blind evangelist, terrific preacher, and great poet. And he was there, asked to come later on in September. And again, there were meetings, there was 200 people there. Over 100 people became believers, baptized believers during that period. And then we had, of course, Robert Eccles, that's William Sloan Eccles' son. He was preaching as well. He was studying at the time in university for medicine. And he was doing preaching. His father was reading some college meeting somewhere. He went out to the church this evening, preached the gospel. Again, the whole thing was people wanted to stay for ages. Were preaching, people were crying, people were repenting of their sin. And it's a different revival from the 1859 revival. There's no lying on the ground and fainting. It's more, as the book points out, it's people actually pinpointing the scriptures as to say why they have peace with God. That's the important thing in that revival. And at one stage, I think Grange was the fourth largest Baptist denomination, or Baptist church, in the whole of Ireland, with 144 members. Post 72. Amazing finding altogether. But there's a lot of people there at Renderson, really. Reverend Henry Phillips, who came after this man, was a great man from Scotland, or from England. He was a pastor for 29 years. Brilliant man, too. Great singer, first tenor. Wife was a contralto, son was a missionary for 45 years in the Congo, Ross Phillips. He's buried, his father and mother are buried in Craigmore, near Grange, 2 miles from the church or thereabouts. Great history there too. Ross brought home a wee boy from Congo, a 14-year-old black boy. He was an interpreter for him, he was a Christian. And sadly he died in Grange when he was home on furlough. And he's buried with the Reverend Phillips and his wife at Craigmore. There's a headstone, you'll see it there. It's referred to in the book. Lovely story that, in many ways. But that's another. There's so many stories and sub-stories in the book. You could spend ages talking about Grange. Amazing story.